Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
And good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about historic preservation, and as a kind of a case study, we'll be talking about a site that a lot of people feel is one of the most important, the best historic sites in our part of the country. It is Pleasant Hill, Kentucky. It was a Shaker religious community. It was founded in 1805, and then there were Shakers there for quite a number of years. It was a thriving community for a long time. However, after the Civil War, the community began to decline, and the last Shaker to live there died in 1923. In 1961, some folks in the area started an organization to preserve the village, and this was at a time when people weren't really talking a lot about historic preservation as we do now. They managed to raise the money, and some people, again, would say that this is probably the country's largest and most completely restored Shaker community, and is a place that a lot of tourists go, and it's also a National Historic Landmark. We will talk this morning in this part of the Focus 580 with Thomas Parrish, who's written a book about the effort to preserve Pleasant Hill. It's a book titled Restoring Shakertown, The Struggle to Save the Historic Shaker Village of Pleasant Hill, and it is published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thomas Parrish has written a number of books on 20th century history, including Roosevelt and Marshall, Partners in Politics and War, and The Submarine, A History. He's also the author of The Grouchy Grammarian, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. People listen to the conversation, questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Parrish, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it doesn't do me any harm either.
I should mention that, too, by the way, if people are interested in finding out more about Pleasant Hill and they have access to the Internet, they do have a website. And so people can go there and find out information about the place.
Surely.
Some of the things that are available. And I expect that probably some of the people who are listening to us this morning, there may be some people who have been there. For those who haven't, perhaps to start, you might just describe the place a little bit. Pleasant Hill like today?
Well, Pleasant Hill like today, quite amazing. Let me make one thing clear before I say anything else, however. This book is not a publicity book about Shakertown. It is an independent history that was commissioned to be done, but it is not, it's not PR in that sense. So
it has
warts as well as beauty spots. But this is a plateau. If you know the bluegrass country of Kentucky, the horse farm country, it's very rolling, beautiful, scenic country, somewhat like the Cotswolds, somewhat like Normandy, you know, lovely country. And in the middle of this sits this remarkable, beautifully preserved Shaker village, a village dating from the early and middle 1800s, very large, substantial stone buildings and winding paths, fields going off into the distance, and it is a remarkable, almost out-of-the-world spot. It's about 40 miles southwest of Lexington, the largest city in the area.
Mm-hmm. And I have to admit that I have not been there, but I know people who have, and they say that it's really very beautiful. It's a lovely spot to
visit. It is. When I go back just to see it or have lunch there or something, I'm always struck by how beautiful it really is and how wonderfully preserved it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we had gone there, say, in the late 1950s, really before the effort got going, what would we have seen?
Well, it would have looked something like an old suit that had been worn out and thrown away, I think. There was a state highway, just an ordinary two-lane road going through it, a rather curving road. There were, along the road, places like a little gas station, a little Shell two-pump station, a general store, a small Baptist church. But behind these buildings, fields were almost like ghosts, large abandoned buildings. And these were the great Shaker edifices that had been built. The Shakers were fantastic builders. And So they were as in the background, you know. I think I wrote in the book something like it was like Karnak or Troy. You were seeing a past civilization that had gone, and then you sort of had the tawdry 20th century strip along the highway. And you would speed through the place and think, as people used to say, it's too bad something can't be done about that wonderful village. It just looks so great. But for years and years it was talked about, but nothing concrete could really get done.
And I guess that even going back to the maybe the 30s at least, people were indeed talking about the possibility of doing something.
Oh, yes, and even before that it had been talked about, but that was really all it was, talk. For example, if some listeners may remember, there used to be an organization called the House of David, whose theology I don't know a thing about, but they used to have a traveling baseball team, guys with very long beards, and that was what good hitters they were, but they certainly had fantastic beards. And they traveled around, and even it was thought back in the 1917, say, that the House of David might buy this, so there, people were always sort of grasping at these straws, you know, would somebody come along and do something with it? But nothing ever concrete it seemed to happen.
Mm-hmm. It seems amazing to me that that if you go back to certainly you go back to the 19th century and you look at the attitudes that people had about important historic buildings, that one might say that there was a shocking lack of concern about their future. I think, for example, about the story that you mentioned in the book that in the 1816, I think this was, people in Philadelphia actually had to organize to keep the state of Pennsylvania from tearing down Independence Hall.
Yes, it is. It's really incredible. We're so used to thinking about things a different way now. We look back and see that that was always the way I was thinking just yesterday for some reason about how people took stones from the Colosseum in Rome to build other buildings. It never occurred to them, gee, this is really a fantastic artifact. We ought to preserve this, you know. Look at what the Romans did. Nobody ever thought about that at all. In the 1960s, the city of New York attacked Penn Station, which was a terrible crime. And in fact, I think the destruction of Penn Station was one of the huge boost for the historic preservation movement.
Yeah. And certainly I'm sure that there are probably all places all over the country, and certainly in Chicago, there are were significant buildings, or at least buildings people thought were significant, that were torn down, and the pieces literally just dumped. Some bits and pieces have survived, but that's an old story.
It's just that outlook, that philosophy, that approach didn't exist until, we'll say, really 40 years or so ago.
Yeah, so even at the time that we're talking about the effort to restore Shakertown getting going in 1961, even at that time, it really wasn't people didn't talk about historic preservation in the way that we do now.
Absolutely, and there was no academic course in the subject then. I think the first one was founded at Columbia about that time.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Thomas Parrish. He is an historian, has written a number of books on 20th century history, and this one that we're talking about here this morning, it's titled Restoring Shakertown, which I think is an effort to document the effort and all of the people that were involved in this and in restoring and preserving Pleasant Hill, an historic Shaker village in Kentucky. Questions are welcome, and we do have someone here ready to go, and others who are listening are certainly welcome to call in. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Belgium, which is over by Danville, on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of questions. To start with, the Shaker community failed in the late 1870s, 1880s, something like that, wasn't it?
Well, it declined progressively, and by 1910 it was pretty well liquidated. Oh, the last surviving Shaker lived on there until 1923.
I see. Now, when they passed away, who did the property go to?
Well, there was a deal made, really, with a local merchant in the nearby town of Harrodsburg, whereby in exchange for, as they used to say in law, good and valuable considerations, he would look after the Shakers in their final years in exchange for rights to the land.
I see.
That was part of it. his heirs, as a matter of fact, I think he died before the last shaker did, so that his heirs sold off part of the land, and it got to be, as usual, complex. Different people owned different tracts and so forth.
I see. Also, to bring a little bit more of a historical aspect, can you explain what relationship the shaker movement might have related to the arts and crafts movement, which is also definitely a woodworking type situation?
Well,
they went more than woodworking; they were in tapestry and
yes, of course.
Too.
It would. I want to say, full disclosure: I do not claim in any sense to be an expert in the shakers. My book was really about the Restoration, but the shaker history, of course, is necessary background. So, with that little warning, I will say I don't think there was any relationship really. I know the arts and crafts, and of course, that's having a surge again, as it does periodically, arts and crafts. The Shakers' principle was, as I understand it, and as people have told me, that the reason they had acquired this fame for their ideas was not that they sat around thinking how to be decorative so much as how to do things in the simplest way to make the best use of God's time. They saw themselves always as servants of God, and what would be the best way to do anything to be most efficient, to be most effective out in the world, as they said. And therefore, you got these wonderful ideas about pegs to hang chairs on, the lines of the furniture, and so forth. I think that they didn't even think of themselves in an aesthetic way. That's my own impression. But rather simply, it's almost as if they had a kind of a spiritually engineered approach to it. So in that sense, I don't see them as relating very much to it, except you might say in a general way, the 19th century, as it went on, was open to such things like arts and crafts and like that.
Well, the arts and crafts movement actually started in Europe and
yes. Mm-hmm.
And very strongly in Scottish movement, then came to the United States with Stickley and Green and several other people.
And, of course, some of the Stickley stuff looks rather like Shaker furniture.
Exactly. That's what I was going to get to.
Yes,
I was wondering if Stickley was influenced by the Shakers.
That may have been the case. I don't think the Shakers were influenced by others, but they could have been, yeah.
Because if you go on, and the culmination of the arts and crafts movement actually comes to Frank Lloyd Wright, and a lot of his designs keep a very straight and austere sort of...
Well, the Shakers still influence people today in that sense.
Yes.
In design, yeah, that's true.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you you acknowledge not being an expert on, particularly an expert on shakers, but there is indeed a kind of a history, a little bit about them in the book. So
yes.
Perhaps you might give us the thumbnail sketch on who the Shakers were. And I suppose one actually should not use the past tense, because I think actually there is still a very small but active Shaker community. I don't think that there are more than four members, but there actually
Maine.
Is one in Maine today.
Yes, there is.
But certainly nothing like the number that there would have been, and mostly I think concentrated in the Northeast and in New England at the time where the movement would have been at its peak.
Well, I'll give you a thumbnail, we might
sure.
say. Yeah. It was founded by a woman known as later as Mother Ann Lee in England, who was a remarkable character, bizarre in many ways, but also a woman of amazing achievement, because without any education or anything else, she adapted elements of the Quaker faith that she knew, borrowed some things from the Anglicans, some stuff out of her own head, and created this kind of new church, you would have to say, transplanted it to America, where everyone went in those days, in the late 18th century, around the time of the Revolution, really. And despite the fact that sex was forbidden, which you would think would not be the best basis for evangelizing, she acquired converts, and they had a church, or two or three, a community, really, two or three near New York City. And at any rate, to skip to the point here, at the beginning of 1805, they sent missionaries out southwest, and they went to Kentucky, walking on foot the whole way. And they arrived at a time of religious revival in the United States, and certainly on the frontier. And this was very important. So they were in tune with fluid, changing religious ideas. This was the era in which the Disciples of Christ, or Christian Church, was having its early days, and it was not yet a sect, but it came out of a meeting in the same area and so forth. So that they then established this community in this wonderfully favored, fertile area at Pleasant Hill in Kentucky, beginning in 1805. And it went on from there. So, as readers may or may not know, the Shakers were celibate, which meant that they got new members either simply by proselytizing or by people coming along seeking shelter, and the Shakers are very hospitable, and by children. They would take in orphans and so forth. I don't mean this in any negative way. They were very good to them in that sense. And so that they were able to exist and grow for years, even though they didn't have what population experts would call a natural increase in the sense of having babies. So at any rate, by the middle of the 19th century, it was a very, very flourishing community, partly because of this ingenuity I was speaking about in relation to design. This had to do with everything they did, agriculture, development of seeds. I think they were the first people in the United States to commercially market seeds. That's my general impression, and so forth. They invented the Shaker broom. They did this. They did that. Two-handed saw, so forth and so on.
Yeah.
All of these things. They were incredibly diligent and incredibly successful, so much so that if you read the book, you will know that Karl Marx's associate, Friedrich Engels, had a utopian dream about the place without ever having seen it. He thought it was sort of the realization of true Marxist ideas on Earth.
Yeah, that was. I think it's an important point that while certainly they were concerned with spiritual matters, they also had to. They knew that they had to support themselves and their community, and they were very successful commercially. They were very hardworking people. They were very ingenious, and for a time, in a commercial sense, if no other, this was indeed a thriving place.
Well, what it showed to me, I thought, my own reflection on this was that the people were recruited without any particular idea of looking for people who were brilliant or people who were mechanically clever, but the focus of the religion and of their ideas brought out the best in everyone in that sense. And it was remarkable to me in showing what ordinary people could do when focused and aimed and pushed in this way to do all the amazing things they did in farming and mechanics and so forth.
The community, I think, began to go into decline after the Civil War. Was the war hard on the place?
Well, yes, but the Civil War changed the culture in general. Hmm. I think that what happened was really the Shakers were it was as if you had an automobile company making cars and they had fine handcrafted cars. Mass production would come along, the price would go way down, and your people would say, those cars are fine, but we can get a perfectly good one for $10,000 less or something. Same way with the Shakers. They ran into increasing mass production in the great economic explosive era after the Civil War, so that they were, in a sense, archaic by then. Mass production was on, and also this early utopian period of the 19th century, which had New Harmony, Indiana, and all kinds of other places of the sort, that era had passed as well. It was now really a more focused, materialistic machine age that had come upon them, and the Shakers didn't really fit into that.
At the peak, how many people lived there?
Several thousand. I think I don't remember the final number, but and it's hard to say when the peak would be. I guess you would have to say around 1850. But it seems to me, fortunately, I told you I'm not an expert in the Shakers, but I think it was a few thousand.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Thomas Parrish. He has written a number of books on 20th century history and is the author of a book entitled Restoring Shakertown, which is an effort to document, as the subtitle says, the struggle to save the historic Shaker village of Pleasant Hill in Kentucky. It is not all that far, I think, from Lexington, and it's a place that today is a National Historic Landmark. A lot of people go there to visit. It's a popular tourist destination. A lot of people would argue that in this part of the country, it's one of the finest historic sites that we have.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, too, that if you have internet access and you'd like to see something more about the place, they do indeed have a website that talks about what they have there and how you can visit and so forth. And a lot of people I know go there and think that it's a very beautiful place. So that's that. And here on the program, questions, of course, are are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. The book, by the way, is published by the University Press of Kentucky. We talked about the fact that at one of the complicating factors at the time when the folks were trying to organize this preservation effort was that the land was all in private hands, and it was held by a number of different people. And, of course, whenever you do something like this, one of the first things that you have to do is raise money. And so that means that in your organization, you'd better have some people who know how to do that. Can you talk a little bit just about this issue right at the beginning of how it is that the people who were interested in preserving the place went about trying to acquire the land?
Well, when they started out, of course, they were people of goodwill, and they were moved to get going because of the destruction of a historic house in Lexington. Again, we're in the early 1950s at that point. And nobody had thought too seriously about whether an old house is more important than a new parking lot and so forth. And then this caused a fellow named Joe Graves originally to say, look, this is too much. We have to stop this getting rid of houses that Henry Clay lived in or whatever it might be. Excuse me. And the people organized, people interested in the idea, and they began something called the Bluegrass Trust, but they didn't have any money, and they didn't really know how to get any. There's always an idea, I think, when people start a new enterprise, that if it's worthwhile, money will somehow come, and people traditionally think that. But money didn't really come. They would negotiate, they would get support from influential people, but it was moving rather glacially, and they would bank report would be something like $16.70 in the bank and so forth, and they would sell little items that people would contribute and so forth. But to skip to what really happened was that one day a fellow came to a meeting brought by another person, and this gentleman who came, named Earl Wallace, was a former vice president of Standard Oil of Ohio, had a background in oil and gas exploration in Kentucky. And then after Standard Oil had gone to New York to Dillon Reed, where he was one of their experts in that side of the business in underwriting issues for new corporations. So he was an experienced Wall Streeter, and as I make a point in the book, it was not that he was a stockman. He wasn't a stockbroker or anything like that. He was an expert in financing companies through bond issues and related kinds of fiscal paper. So that he went. And this was a man who was now semi-retired, loved the challenge, and not only did he get there, he was very quickly named chairman of the enterprise. And as he said, well, my name was on it, and I figured I really had to do something about it. But he discovered, as everybody else discovered, that Shakertown, much as people might like the idea of it, was not like a hospital that had a constituency because it served a community and people that had an appendix out there and all that. Or it wasn't like a college that people had gone to. It didn't have a natural body of supporters. It had some admirers, but not a natural body of people who automatically would give it money. And so the challenge from then on, and then we're going back to 1961, 62, the challenge was how to get money for a place out in the country, not in town, and not with an automatic, as you might say, service area, such as many institutions have. And the book is really the account of how this was done. I think this is the core part of the book, and it's a wonderful story to me. Yeah.
We have a caller, and someone else who'd like to join the conversation here in Pontiac, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm a big fan of Shakertown. I've been there over the years several times, most recently last fall. And I guess I just want to say that the feel of staying overnight in one of those buildings is very unique.
Yes. It is sort of literally going to the 19th century, don't you?
Oh, it's just a very peaceful, restful place. I found myself getting up before dawn, and it was warm enough that I could just open one of the side doors, which are massive, and just stand there and watch the sun kind of rise over the whole village. And it was just, I don't know. It's just you don't often get to actually stay in a real historic building. You know,
yes.
You're usually in a reproduction or something.
Exactly right. That's a very good point, yes.
And spending, and of course the food is incredible.
Yeah, it is an amazing experience. That's true. And as I say, I have no connection with Shakertown, and this isn't a publicity book at all, but everything you say is right.
It would be a wonderful place, and I know they advertise that for someone to have retreats or business meetings, because it really takes you away from the outside world in a sense, and so you can really concentrate on whatever you're there for and get a lot of enjoyment out of it at the same time. I just think it's so wonderful that it was saved. And
well, I don't mean to take your subject away, but what you're saying is a thing that's close to my own heart. Namely, that the people who were founding it back in this 1960, 61, 62 period realized that they were taking on a tremendous challenge to raise this money for the reasons I mentioned. And so they said, and you can read in their correspondence and minutes of the meetings and so forth, that we must dedicate them to some higher purpose to justify the great effort that will be required. They had no idea the effort was going to be even greater than they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so they talked about the idea of, because it was a peaceful and could be a beautiful retreat, that you could have conferences and other things exploring great issues. And they talked about this in their work. And this is something I think today, unfortunately, later administration let this lapse in the since about 2000, I guess. Not the period that I covered in my writing, but what was established, and going back to the 1970s, was what was called the Shakertown Roundtable, and this was a statewide forum of issues important to Kentucky and to the area as it evolved, and some of it led to, in part, to the famous Kentucky Education Reform Act, which became one of the pioneer ones in the United States and through the 1990s. But a lot of this came out of discussions at Shakertown, where you would see at this roundtable former governors and journalists and historians and businessmen and so forth meeting for weekend conferences. And I did have a connection with that, in that for some time I was asked to write up the conferences annually for a book that they would publish every year. So I did have a hand in that, and I'm not probably a wholly objective observer, because I could see how much good these things did, and I hope that they will get resumed at some point. But your point, your feeling, is exactly the way they felt in starting it, that this place is so serene that it would be a wonderful place of contemplation to see what do we do next.
Right. And I can't help but thinking that Mother Anne would be very pleased at how it's being used today by people, and would encourage that kind of...
Yes, I think she might be amazed at a great many things.
I think so. Well, thanks very much. It's nice to hear you talk about it, and I will look for your book.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. And again, other people who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, the book is titled Restoring Shakertown by our guest Thomas Parrish. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. It's interesting, I think, if you could list the potential motives for wanting to restore and preserve Pleasant Hill, that people might, on the one hand, say, well, it might be down the road, but this is something that would be good for tourism and to bring in money into the area. That might be one. The other might be those people who'd say, yeah, well, yes, but also that it's an opportunity to document a way of life of a particular people, and perhaps a set of values, and not to document them, and also to give people the chance to, perhaps in some small way, experience that, take part in that experience. And that's the kind of thing that you can't put a price tag on. If you look at the motivations of people over time who were involved with Pleasant Hill, and you look at those two things, one, the possibility of bringing tourists, and it certainly has. The other, the possibility of representing and preserving, talking about a certain kind of values, and it has. How do you, over time, how have those two things balanced out? Or have there been times that one seemed to be the predominant thing, or the other seemed to be the predominant thing?
I think you covered that very well. As a matter of fact, well, yeah, I could say a couple of things. initially, the town of Harrodsburg, which was famous as the first real settlement west of the Alleghenies, I think, Ed and Boonesboro have argued about that, but in any case, Harrodsburg was the first permanent one, I think. The editor of the local paper there was very active, and she saw immediately, she was quite a driving person, that this could be a great source of dollars, economic benefit to her county, and she pushed it, always pushed it, and any time anybody came along with an idea, she supported it, and she was much involved in what ultimately proved to be the successful idea. So that was the first thing, yes. Tourist dollars for the local economy, that was one level. The second thing was people seeing this in an aesthetic way. Here's this beautiful thing, and would be a grace to the landscape, so to speak. And then following from that, behind it is the Shakers and their ideas. And we could learn, as you said, about a past form of culture, in a sense. And this would be important. And the third thing is, as your caller said, about taking from the serenity of the place and going on to have conferences, as I went on to say, ideas, philosophies, even political debates, whatever, but taking this serene landscape as a site of a forum. So those are the three things. Now, the conflict, as you were implying here, is to some extent between those who saw the buildings as buildings and the Shakers as the subject of whatever effort was put into it, and those who thought, oh, that's very well, but we have here a place and we could discuss NATO or the future of education or whatever here as well. And that was something of a conflict. Earl Wallace, the man I mentioned, who was, its existence is due to him and his financial ingenuity and his incredible drive. The existence of Shakertown today is due to him. He died in, 1990 or 91. But his persistence and really cleverness and audacity as well is what got the place financed and continuing to be financed all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So his drive was for conferences. He had very little interest in the Shakers, as Shakers, I have to say. He liked things aesthetically done properly and all of that. And once that was done and the financing was going on, it was always a struggle to keep it going, by the way. Yeah. He wanted the Shakertown Roundtable was his baby. That's what he really got increasingly interested in. The other people there, his successor president, I won't go into the different titles, but the succeeding effective head, had an aesthetic view, did not like Wallace's, his name was Jim Thomas, did not like Wallace's concentration on the idea level, so to speak, and thought Wallace was neglecting the infrastructure and all of this. Well, that was a conflict that I ran into in working on the book. These two people who had somewhat opposed ideas as it developed. However, Wallace was the boss all the time he was there, and he lived into his 91st year, so he was there for a long time. So that was the conflict that you see, and I think it would still exist, and it may be one reason that the roundtable isn't going on now is that the preservationists, so to speak, have been in the saddle. But I hope, frankly, that this will change. I'm just telling you what I really think about it.
Sure.
And I would like to see this happen very much.
So just in rounds, what did it cost to do this?
Oh, I don't think I can. I don't know if I can tell you that offhand. It didn't happen all at once. They had to figure out how to even get money, and private donors just weren't coming through. So, in those days, the federal government was beginning to get active. This is Kennedy administration we're going back to, in some unprecedented ways. And we had the Area Redevelopment Administration, and to condense the story, Wallace managed to get a loan out of them. And this was, they didn't make loans for historic preservation, but he got it in the guise of providing employment and economic development in that county, which was the sort of a baseline argument for the project in the first place on the part of the local people. So this was whatever the loan was for at the time.
I think it was $2 million.
Was it $2 million?
I think so.
Okay, fine.
So. Which at that time would probably actually have been some money.
$2 million, say $12 million today.
Yeah.
I've usually used a multiplier of about six. And yes, and it was amazing. And then not only did that, he then had to get supplementary loans, and then he had to figure out ways to pay that back. And ultimately, through his ingenuity, the government sort of ended up paying itself back in ways that you would have to read the book to see. Mm. But it was fascinating to figure that out, absolutely fascinating.
Well, I tell you, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show, and we do have some other callers, a couple. We'll bring in here next. Let's talk with someone in Decatur, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Why, my family and I have visited there several years ago, or several times in the past years, and last time about 10 years ago. And that lady that recommended, I would second that. But I've kind of forgotten why. Was it always known as Shakers, or was that a nickname, or did it start out as some other religious name or something like that? I've forgotten that part.
Well, it was Shakers because they literally did. It was like anything else, a nickname. It was Shakers because they literally had these dances they would go into in which they would shake. And if you see the, there's a large room in the, one of their central buildings, and they carefully designed it so it would not have supporting pillars, and so the Shakers wouldn't crash into them when they were shaking, as I was told, at least. It almost sounds like apocryphal, but I was told this. So that was, these gyrations are very important, and I think that the fact that the word Shakers sounds like Quakers is important to you, so you can take the word shaking Quakers and telescope it into Shakers, and I suspect that's etymologically what happened.
Yeah, well...
But, that was a nickname, of course, yes.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, and as I say again, it's not that far. The Battle of Perrysville is nearby. And
yes, it is.
Of course, Harrisburg has a lot of history and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
thank you for the program.
All right, sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so the I don't think that the Shakers did. They never called themselves that. Did
no,
they?
As I said, I think it was. Well, they did say Shakertown, though. On the other hand,
Okay. As I guess my thought was that at least originally, other people called them that, and it was kind of a slur. I mean, it wasn't friendly.
No, that's the way with most things. I mean, Gothic Cathedral, after all, Gothic was a sort of opprobrious nickname originally, you know. And now we think of that as, of course, the standard term for Notre Dame or any other cathedral, you know.
Oh, well, let's talk with someone else. Someone in Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a question here. I hear you talk of millions of dollars and big committees, and I think, oh, my goodness. We've got a... Church has an old house they like to restore. We've been told, you know, done professionally, probably cost $170,000, which is out of our reach, I think. My question was, could you give any suggestions for getting people interested? There's almost no one interested in it. It's in a small village out in the country, and
Well, yes, you might contact the National Trust for Historic Preservation in Washington.
Well, they would, you know, if we got a loan, I don't know how we'd ever pay it back.
Well, I would start there and see what they recommended, really.
Okay.
I mean, they might put you in contact with some people with specific interest in the kind of thing you have or something of that sort. That would just be a starting point.
The National Trust. Well, see, in Indiana, we've got Historical Preservation, and they would loan us money. I don't know if we could ever pay it back.
Well,
yeah, you know, and what we could do with it, that's a problem, too. I was just wondering if you can make suggestions as to how to raise some interest locally.
Well, you have to have an organization.
Well, that's about three people.
And you have to have the newspaper interested in it and the local media. I mean, that's sort of the classic way.
Okay.
And you have to get enough people in so there's a, as they say in the book business, there's a buzz about the project.
Yeah.
That's what you really want to start. And maybe, now, speaking of Indiana, one of the great benefactors of Shakertown was the younger Eli Lilly. I mean, he wasn't younger then, but he wasn't the original Eli Lilly.
Right.
And Mr. and Mrs. Lilly used to come down in their chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce to Shakertown, loved the place, and there's a wonderful story that... Earl Wallace said this back many years ago. They needed some money, and they talked to the Lillies about needing $100,000 in 1960s dollars. And Mr. Lilly said, well, okay, we'll go back and talk to the foundation. Well, this is no doubt a formality since they presumably were the foundation pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
But at any rate, the next morning, the Lillys came down to breakfast, and Mr. Lilly said, well, we just decided to just to give you the $100,000 as a personal check from us. And Earl Wallace's comment was to his daughter, I guess they took that out of the grocery money.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, well, I appreciate your guidance.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
It never hurts to have rich friends.
No, it certainly doesn't.
That's right. Before this, there were maybe a couple of major notable historic preservation efforts on a very large scale, and you mentioned them, one of them being William Colonial Williamsburg.
Yes.
And there actually is a connection between that and Pleasant Hill.
Yeah, a very close one because... James Coger, the sort of aesthetic, original aesthetic person at Williamsburg, worked with John D. Rockefeller Jr. and his people, and this was a pioneering thing again. Coger had he sort of trained himself in a sense in that field. He was originally a Kentuckian, and when he was back in Kentucky for other reasons, Earl Wallace nabbed him. He had retired from Williamsburg at this time. Earl Wallace nabbed him to be the guiding aesthetic genius of Shakertown, which he certainly proved to be, was brilliantly successful, as all you have to do is look at it and see. But, yeah, it's interesting, too, because Williamsburg and Shakertown are different in that Shakertown has the original buildings. They've had work done on them, but these are not reproductions. This is lady who called a while ago said. Hmm. These are the original buildings, where Shakertown, where it's Colonial Williamsburg is, as I understand, I've been there, and I didn't have a guide as to which was original or not, but much, I think most of it is actually reproductions, recreations of the buildings.
Yeah. Now, I think that they've put a lot of effort into trying to study original designs and original methods.
Yeah.
So that they're trying to make it as much like the original as they could, but the fact of the matter is, yes, it is a reconstruction.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other place that you mentioned that actually I have been when I was a kid, that's also interesting but a different sort of example, is Greenfield Village, this place that Henry Ford put together where he went out and he got historic buildings and took them apart and brought them there to, this is in Dearborn, and mm-hmm. there you can tour, for example, Tom Edison's workshop, and I think the Wright Brothers bike shop is there, and another buildings like that where he just went out, and of course Mr. Ford could do this because he had, maybe he took that out of his grocery money. He took it and he got the structures and bought them and had them taken apart and moved there. So there's now this enormous, that's a huge place, and they have all kinds of amazing stuff there. He was quite the collector. You know, he liked to collect trains. Well, he didn't have little trains. He collected steam engines, the real thing. And you can walk around and you can see all these buildings. And it's really interesting, but that's, I think some people would argue that it is a historic preservation, and yet it's not preserving things on their original site, which also, I think some people would argue, that's kind of part of the deal, you know, keeping things the way, as much as you can, keeping things the way that they were.
Oh, yeah, the intellectual preservationists frown on Greenfield Village a great deal, but I'd love to go there. I've never been there, but I'd like to just to see the things wherever they came from, just to see some of them.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating place, and I, you know, if I'd like to think if you were a little boy or you still had some little boy in you, you would just go crazy. It was just an amazing experience. But then, you know, when I was there, I probably was about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old, or maybe younger than that, and I was pretty much bowled over by that.
I've got quite a bit of the little boy left myself.
Oh, well, good for you. Try to hold on to that. Let's go and talk with someone else. Bloomington, Indiana is the next caller here, line number 4. Hello.
You mentioned that Eli Lilly used to visit the Shakers, and I know that Eli Lilly had a great love for historic people of the prairies and the plains, and he started Connor Prairie, or he had a lot that there's a kind of pioneer village in, I think it's just north of Indianapolis, called Connor Prairie. Do you know whether Eli Lilly, whether his contribution to Connor Prairie had anything to do with his love of the Shakers?
No, I do not. I don't know a thing about it, but He was interested in history, indeed, and wrote little monographs on historic subjects. I know that. So certainly was, but I'm sorry, I don't know a thing about Connor Prairie. But he came down, you said visit the Shakers. He came to visit Shakertown. He didn't have any, of course, connection with the Shakers themselves, just to make that point clear.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We have a couple minutes left here. Someone wants to call real quick. They can get in, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess, you know, thinking back to the caller who called from Indiana who was thinking about some buildings that they would like to preserve, that sometimes a preservation effort, obviously it rests on having some people to whom it's important enough to want to put in the energy and time to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, you got to have money, and it doesn't hurt if some of those people have money, or at least they know how to raise money. So there are a lot of things you have to have going for you. And it sounds like that part of it, the deal is, it may be in some cases, it may just be luck that somehow things manage to go your way. Certainly there are a lot of buildings that end up not being preserved. And
no.
And I suppose also some people would argue that, well, you know, we really can't preserve everything, and maybe we shouldn't preserve everything. But it makes you wonder, why it is that some places like Pleasant Hill are saved and other places not.
Well, I think the book, to some extent, can serve as a case history about that, a story that's a case history. And also, I have to say, though, on the other hand, that Shakertown exists today really because they did, by luck, come across the one person who had the drive and the financial know-how and the persistence and was able to put the time in on it to bring it all off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had Wallace was a remarkable fellow. I knew and got to know him very well. He was a remarkable person. But this endless ingenuity and persistence was the thing. Now, at the same time, the book would help a lot of people in how to organize and get people interested in what you have to go through to do it. And there's a lot of useful information about that, I think, in the book, too. But, yes, there is luck, of course, involved and everything like that. But they did have a good product, and they could show the potential, and that it even, to some extent, swayed the hard hearts of the area Redevelopment Administration.
Right. One thing I need, just been handed here some weather information we want to get out to people. The National Weather Service has issued a flood warning for select locations along the following rivers, the Iroquois and Kankakee, with rainfall totals ranging from 1/4 inch to 3/4 throughout Thursday morning, and more rain expected through the weekend based on current trends. They expect that could create flooding along area rivers and streams. Localized heavier rain may create additional flooding across other areas. For the Iroquois, including Iroquois, minor flooding is forecast. For the Kankakee, including Dunn's Bridge, Couch Shelby, minor flooding is forecast. We'll try to keep you informed of this information here throughout the day. We are expecting that we could here in our area and other parts of Illinois and Indiana have some more heavy rain, so that's something to keep in mind. If we do have warnings, we'll certainly get them to you as quickly as we possibly can, and then throughout the day, of course, we'll have more on the weather for you. In fact, next time we'll have a comprehensive look at the weather. We'll be about 12:35 as part of the afternoon magazine. Celeste Quinn, of course, is the host for the program. Let's see if we can get maybe one more caller in here in the time that remains in Champaign, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just as long as you're talking about moving things off their site, the historic Mumford building is being considered a case for movement to another location, and that, I think, would be sad. So I just wonder the audience to know that that is happening locally.
And that's something that's on the on the U of I
campus? It's a prototype farm building.
Oh, right. This was, yes, I do remember.
No. Very near to Mumford Hall.
Yeah. Isn't though the idea of moving it to try to preserve it?
I think it depends, but the historic site is very important.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah.
Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And certainly, if people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are interested in preservation, there is a preservation organization here in Champaign County So if people are interested in what's going on here in our county, whether there are buildings that are considered to be endangered and what people are doing in the way of historic preservation, the Preservation Council here in Sham County does that, and I'm sure that folks could get in touch with them and find out about the effort. So if they want to be involved in that kind of thing here in a local way.
Eternal vigilance.
Absolutely. Well, we're just about at the point, I think, where we're going to have to finish up. And as we mentioned here a couple of times, and as the callers have mentioned, people can go to Pleasant Hill. You can actually even, you can go on a tour, so you could just go for the day and walk around, but people also can stay there.
Yes.
And they do indeed have a website, so if you want to get information about the place, you can do that. And here, Mr. Parrish and I have no commercial interest whatsoever here. We're just putting the information out there just for information. Any last sort of thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, the book is Restoring Shakertown, and I would just invite people to read it and perhaps get involved in historic preservation. It's a wonderful thing to do.
All right. Well, Mr. Parrish, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Our guest, Tom Parrish, he's written a number of books on 20th century history, including one titled Roosevelt and Marshall, Partners in Politics and War. He has also written military history. It's all about the submarine, and the title of that book is The Submarine, A History. And if you'd like to read this book that we've mentioned here this morning, it's entitled Restoring Shakertown, The Struggle to Save the Historic Shaker Village of Pleasant Hill, and it is published by the University Press of Kentucky.